It was the story of Moshe's meeting with Yitro, correct? Moshe saved his daughters from the shepherds. They were being driven away. Moshe intervened and saved them. He wore the sheep. And then Yitro invited him to stay with him. Right? That's in Chafalos. By Yoel, Moshe was seven to say this. And Moshe agreed to live with the man, to stay with him. And he gave Tzipporah, his daughter, to Moshe. And then she gave birth to a son, and she called his name Gershom, and he called the name Gershom, for he said, I was a stranger in a foreign land. Now, as I pointed out last time, Rashi on Vayoel brings out a medrash, which is very strange, because the plain meaning is that he agreed to live with him, to stay with him. Rashi says, however, that he swore to him. I don't know, where, it's like funny, where does he get this from? He says he swore to him that Rachel lost an olaf. It's an expression of an oath. He swore to him that he wouldn't leave Midian without his permission. So right off the bat, see, I'm trying to teach you a little bit of methodology. In order to come to some of the ideas, you have to spot the problem. This should figure out something in your mind, like, well, where does this come from? It doesn't make sense. You know, people read Chumash, they read the Midrashim, and they don't question it. It doesn't make sense. We're dealing with Moshe Rabbeinu, just for people on a very high level. What was the basis of this oath? What was the context of this oath? Why would, I assume it was at the behest of Yisro, right? Why would Moshe have taken an oath unless it was Yisro that imposed it, so to speak? Why? What kind of an idea is it? And it's even before he marries his daughter. I mean, if you want to say it's because of he didn't want to be separated from his daughter and so forth, which there's no basis to say that anyway, but even so, it takes place immediately, and it's before the marriage. So why would he impose it, and why would Moshe agree to it? Doesn't make sense. Okay, that's my first question. Now, what happens next, the scenario, is, as you know, he marries Tzipporah, and then he's working as a shepherd for his father-in-law, and he takes his sheep into the wilderness, and then the incident of the burning bush. All right, I'm not going to go through all that now. You're familiar with it. Moshe engages in this lengthy, because I'll say he was there for 7 days, arguing with God. Again, he was pleading with God not to force him to become the leader of the Jewish people, not to be given this mission. But finally, he has no choice and he has to accept it. In the end, God gets angry with him. And he has to accept it. So, right before he goes to Egypt, he takes his leave of Yisro. Let's pick it up from that point again. And that is found on chapter 4, Yitzchak 18, 4:18. Alright? It says that Moshe went and returned to his father-in-law, Yeser. He was known, he had seven names. Yeser, missing a letter from Yisro. That's before he converted. His name was increased. By Yom Elo, and he said to him, now listen to what he says to his, and you tell him what the problem is with this puppet. Let's see if you can spot the problem. And he said to him, please now let me go, I will go, and return to my brothers that are in Egypt, and I will see if they are still alive. And Yisro said to Moshe, go in peace. Now, what's the problem? Rashi says on 18, by Yosef al Yisro Chosno, he returned to his father-in-law, Li Tol Rishus. He Rashi follows through in his idea. See, what did he come for? He needed his permission. He was under some kind of an oath. Sharei Nishbalo. For he had sworn to him that he wouldn't leave Midian without his permission. So Rashi is following through on what he said before, that he wasn't just going to say goodbye, and the language itself is sort of like, no means please. He's sort of asking him whether he could go, although that's not the plain shot. The truth of the matter is, You have to know how to use a mezzer. The plain meaning is that he just came to take his leave and said goodbye in a nice kind of a way. And he gives him a reason. All right, but Rashi incorporates it into the Medrash that really was more than just that, but there was an oath. Okay, one hit. Yeah. This question is right to the point. Because on two counts, first of all, the justification, apparently, it was very important to Yisro that Moses didn't leave Midrash. He wanted him around. Well, why, we don't know, but he wanted him around. So therefore, to go back, to leave, and go especially to a place like Egypt, which was not a great place to go to at that time, because Jews were oppressed and enslaved, you'd think he'd come up with something really significant, something meaningful. Instead, he comes up with the weakest, the lamest possible kind of reason with it. It's just I'll return to my brothers that are in Egypt, and I'll see if they're still alive. What kind of thing is that? What are you going to go to see if they're still alive, as opposed to what? Then maybe they're not alive, maybe they're dead. Well, what's the point? I'll go and I'll see if they're still alive. You don't have to go. If you want to find out if they're still alive, you can send a messenger. I'm sure that they had ways of communicating in those days. Caravans, whatever. It may not have been as sophisticated as we are. But the whole thing just doesn't hit. It doesn't, is it just convincing? And yet Yisro says, go and see. But the question is on Moshe. Moreover, the question becomes even stronger. He had the most perfect reason in the world, something which would have not required. Here he was taking a chance, in fact, because Yisro could have said, no, what are you, that's crazy. All right, Yisro didn't. But the if I was in that situation, I would have said, I'm going because I have no choice. God spoke to me, and God, he would have told him that the whole incident with the burning bush, and the mission and everything. Why didn't he tell them that? Yes? Lest you think that for some reason this was supposed to remain a secret and Moshe was not supposed to tell. Obviously we know that's not true. That's not true because, yes, as soon as he came to Mitzrayim, he told the Cain, he told everybody knew. But it was no secret at all. So, certainly, he had every right, I would imagine. God did not tell him not to tell you so. And if that's the case, then it becomes, to me, it becomes a major question as to why he would abandon the most obvious and convincing explanation in favor of something which is very lame. I mean, there's two sides to this question. There's two sides. One question is, see, when you join the two together, it's really two questions. One is, why didn't he give him the good reason, the convincing one? The other one is, if for whatever reason, so pick something that makes sense. He chooses something which is so lame that it's hard to imagine that you should just accept it. He says, I'll go and see my brother if they're still alive. Doesn't sound like anything. I mean, that's a possibility. The first thought that came to mind, and was totally false, but you have to go through the possibilities, was that it was because of Moshe's aniva. I thought that Moshe was an honor, and that he didn't want to tell him. Yeah, well, that's why I'm wrong. My first, but that's not uneven. That would be no contradiction to his uneven. Because the fact is, he went to Mitzrayim and he told the Jews, uneven doesn't mean denial of reality. When he set up, Moshe knew that he was in the highest level. Moshe knew that he knew other Navi. Most people have a false idea of humility, of uneven. They think it means that you say that you're low, that you're not smart, that I'm not the... That's not uneven. The person can recognize that he's the biggest Thomas Huckleman, to be a humble person. Because humbleness means the effect that this has upon his sense of himself. He doesn't feel any sense of being important in the scale of the universe. He realizes how small he is. And he's living in the realm of the reality of God. A person is only egotistical because he's living in the world of the comparative. He compares himself to others, which is a false barometer. It's not reality. So he just looks at other people, and he sees that he's a little bit ahead of them, but he feels great, which is absurd. His sense about where he stands, his significance in the scheme of things, should be based upon reality. That's why David says, what is man that you remember? He was looking at the whole scheme of reality, and that scheme, man, is very small. Oh, but in the human system, it would be, I mean, a person is a great doctor,
He can still be humble, yet when somebody comes with a problem, he'll treat him because he knows he has the knowledge.
The same thing with Lord Gavin.
So, I agree with you, Warren. I mean, that's not the reason. Now, I did consider the possibility. Not that Yisrael didn't believe in God. Yisrael did. Moshe would not have married his daughter. Moshe would not have stayed with him. Yisrael was a high-level individual. We see later on, he converted to Judaism. And he had all the names that he was put in Nidu, in Chayr, he was excommunicated because he had given up idolatry. It says he had studied every idolatry system and he rejected it. He was a man of God. So that he believed in the same God as Moshe Rabbeinu. If he didn't, then Moshe wouldn't have anything to do with him, I assure you. He would not have stayed with him and he wouldn't have married his daughter. The only thing that I thought perhaps Yisro didn't know about prophecy, about Nevuah. But then I realized that wouldn't be a good answer. Because if that's the case, he should have told him about these phenomena itself, and he would have believed them, and he would have learned from them. You see? So for all of these things, all of these possible reasons that came to mind, one after the other, I rejected. And I was stuck. I was stuck. I had the question, and I was stuck. I couldn't go any further. The answer came from a different place. And sometimes it's just that, you know, you can't answer the question immediately, you just have to have information. Let's go somewhere else now, to where the answer came from. I mean, I'm assuming it's a good answer. The answer you came from. Picked up after the Assyrians are trying to send out the 10 plagues, the Jews are out of Egypt, the splitting of the Red Sea, and some of the travails in the... This immediate story, according to Rashi, takes place actually right before the revelation of Sinai. Which means that they've already had some rebellions over the water. The man has come down already. They've had the man. And they fought the war against Amalek. It says that Yisro, the Kohen of Midian, the Kohen means he was a man of God. He taught the ideas of God. Actually, he was an Noahide. You know, he kept the Noahide Lord. The father-in-law of Moshe, he heard everything that God had done for Moshe and for Israel, his nation, that God had taken Israel from Egypt, taken them out of Egypt. Bear in mind now what the key emphases are, what it was that really was important to him. And Yisro, the father-in-law of Moshe, took Sipporah, the wife of Moshe, after he had sent her away. Alright, now according to Rashi, when he went down to Mitzrayim, he took his Sipporah and Gershom with him. But then, according to Rashi, according to Chazal, when Aaron saw, he rebuked him, and he had him saying, he said, we have enough. Why? The Jews that are here are enslaved already. Why are you bringing more people to be enslaved? So he sent his wife and child back home. Alright, Yisro came with Sipporah, and the Eish Nevanen, and the two sons, the name of one of whom was Gershom, which repeats again, for he said, I was a stranger in a foreign land. And the name of the other one was Eliezer, for the God of my father would help me, and he saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. That's another key we're going to take up, the significance of the two names that he gave to his son. But that's a separate key. Now, Yisro, the father of Moshe, and his sons and wife came to Moshe to the desert, and he was camping there by the mountain of God. And he said, now this Pasuk Vav is, Rashi says, Yisro sent a messenger. It's not Yisro himself talking directly to Moshe at this point. And so he said to Moshe, I, your father-in-law, Yisro, have come to you with your wife and your two sons with us. Then Moshe went out to meet his father. So you see that the prior one was through a messenger. Then Moshe went out towards his father-in-law, and he bowed down to him, and he kissed him. And the men inquired of each other, how, you know, they renewed their acquaintance, how they're doing, how you doing. And they went into the tent. And Moshe told his father-in-law, now here again, listen very carefully, Moshe told his father-in-law everything that God had done to Pharaoh and to Egypt for the sake of the Jews, of Israel, and all of the travails that they had encountered on the road, on the way, and God had saved them. Okay, so Moshe recounted everything that had occurred to him. And what was this? Now we have Yisro's reaction. And Yisro rejoiced for all the good that God had done to Israel that he had saved them from the hand of Egypt. And Yisro said, blessed is God who saved you from the hands of Egypt and from the hands of Pharaoh, who saved the nation from under the hand of Egypt. Now I know that God is greater than all the gods, for in the matter that they had sinned against them. Okay? And Yisro, the father of Moshe, took Olah, the Kavan Olah, that's a sacrifice, which is completely consumed. You don't partake of it. You don't need it. Uzvachim. Uzvachim are sacrifices that part of it is to God, part of it Shlomim, peace offerings for God. And Aaron and all the elders of Israel came to eat bread with the father of Moshe before God. That's the end of the segment. They all came, they all joined, they all ate bread. Where was Moshe in this meal? Anybody know the famous Rashi? What was Moshe doing? Rashi is. Moshe was the main reason for being there. He was the main figure. But what happened? He skipped the meal? Humblest. Moshe was the waiter. Moshe says it. So Rashi says, take a look. Well, Moshe hasan halach. Follow who said yes to the grotto. And Moshe was the one who came to meet him. Vagarm lost color covers. He was the cause of all this honor. So he wouldn't stay for the meal. I would say, oh, maybe when Shammai Shasam. He stood and he served Tommy to come. That's his level. Okay, that's a side point. Now, are there any questions concerning this parsha here? Any questions? First of all, it's very interesting. It's an amazing thing. I'm not going to dwell on this. I'm just going to point it out that this whole major reunion, the whole focus is on who? The reunion occurs between who and who? Between Moshe and Yisro. There's no mention of anything between Moshe and Zipporah, or Moshe even and his son. Nothing. I mean, I'm sure they... he noticed them or whatever, but the Torah doesn't see fit to record it. The whole reunion, the whole get-together, the whole excitement is between Moshe and Yisro. Okay. Are there any questions over here? Any problems that you'll notice? Anything that doesn't fit 100%? Bori says, it would seem from this, that's a very good question. I mentioned before that Yisro did believe in God, but Yisro seems to be implying in Pasuk Yud Aleph that now I know that God is greater than the other gods. But the whole statement is very strange. Because what do you mean greater than the other gods? Does that mean that he still believes in the other gods? But anyways, if we take it to mean that now he's recognized God and he didn't before, then that's difficult to accept. He was Kohen. What kind of Kohen was he? He didn't accept God. That's one question. Okay. What else? The question that I had is that I understand what was his reaction. He reacted with joy. He was very happy for what happened to the Jews. Right? That he was a tzaddik. You see, he was a tzaddik. Because a person that wasn't a tzaddik wouldn't rejoice. Well, usually people in general don't rejoice when good happens to other people. They don't. That's a high level. I want you to know it's a very high level. It may sound strange. When people rejoice for the good that happened to somebody else, it's usually if there's like a close friendship, there's identification and so forth. But even so, if you're really honest with yourself, if something good happens to your friend, you rejoice. But if it's too good, too far out of your league, right? I don't know how much rejoicing there's not. There's rejoicing, but there are other emotions as well. But to rejoice for strangers, something that happened to the Jews. Well, he didn't know the Jews. He just knew Moshe, but I mean, he wasn't related to the Jews. To rejoice over the fact that God had saved the Jews, right? And it was a major thing to him. It was really sincere. That is something. I don't know how much you've read about. You have enough of your own experiences. We have enough to go by. For example, the breakdown of the communist empire in Europe, which took place recently. Okay, so we're happy to, well, we don't know if it'll be good for the Jews in Russia. Not good, though. You know, there's both good and bad. But let's eliminate that element of it, right? We're happy because the Jews are free, the Jews can work it. But what about the other countries that were oppressed by communism, and now they're free? So they were rejoicing, right? All these countries were rejoicing. How many How many people over here really care? Nobody really cares. Right? And if... Yes, that's selfish. But you don't care. You're not interested. It's only because, you know, it made your situation a little bit better. Right? But there are people struggling for independence, oppression, and so forth. When people break free from oppression, you don't really rejoice. You could care less. It doesn't affect... Unless it affects you somehow. Who cares, right? Okay. The matter is, there's two obligations. You know, to commiserate... It's one chesed. It's one thing to commiserate with people when they're in trouble, you know, like to console the mourner. That's one mitzvah. And then there's to rejoice with another person in their time of simcha. Now I wonder which one is a greater thing to do. Which is more difficult to do? Sometimes it's hard to do. It's a very big mitzvah, by the way. Mitzamei Chosam Mekal is a very, very big mitzvah. We see that in Tanakh Yizavel, you know, that she was the worst Russia of all in Tanakh. And yet she did one mitzvah. She danced at weddings in Mitzamei Chosam Mekal. So she was rewarded. Yeah, head to head, right. On a deep psychological level, you see that sometimes, like they say, you know, fair weather friend, right? But then there's another kind of phenomenon. There's the foul weather. There's certain people that are always there when things are bad for you, but they're not around when you're rejoicing. Psychologically, apparently, they get, you know, they're good for you when things are going badly, because that's not a threat to them. See? That's not a threat to them. So in a certain sense, there's a certain satisfaction. They may not be conscious of it. I'm not putting people down. But there is a certain satisfaction. That's why people are fascinated, they're attracted to it. They see a big crash, rubbernecking, big accident. There's a certain fascination. You don't think about it consciously, but in a certain sense, it didn't happen to me. A certain satisfaction. That confirms my sense of my importance in this world. This terrible calamity happened, it didn't happen to me. Certain satisfaction over there. On the other hand, when something very good happens to somebody else, as I said, up to a point, you know, it happens to him. That if it's something which you really can't identify with, then it can be very troublesome. That all this good fortune has happened to the other person, not happened to you. To take the real tzaddik, to rejoice, if this tremendous good happens to somebody else, and it won't happen to me. Okay. Now, the other question, as Lori pointed out, this is what bothered me, is that I understand that he blesses God. That makes sense. In fact, Chazal say that until Yisro came along, nobody had blessed God for the miracle. Even the Jews. The Jews had sung Shira, it is true, but they had not blessed God, and Yisro was the first to come along and actually bless God for what he had done. But what is the idea of the sacrifice, especially of the Ola? What was the basis for bringing it? What was the reason? The Jews didn't bring the carbon Ola. There was no obligation, and there's no criticism. What was the concept behind the carbon Ola? What was the idea of bringing it? Here I said that, what does it mean, now I know that God is greater than all the gods? So, look, yes, look, good. And your Allah, Ati Adati, Makiro Yishiva Shavar, I recognized him before. So that eliminates that. So I believed in God before, the Achshav of the Yosef, and now I recognize him even more. So there was a change. But my question is like this. What does that mean? I mean, I believed in God before, and I believe in him more now. How can you believe more or less? I mean, isn't belief in God, either you believe or you don't believe? Right? I mean, what does this mean? Either you believe in God, or do you believe in God before? If so, what do you mean? I believe in God even more now? Then did you believe in God before? What happened? In other words, an essential transformation had occurred. Yeah. In other words, yes, there are different degrees of Amuna. For example, as you see by who? By Noah. It said that when Noah, it said he entered the Mehamalo, that he got onto the ark from before the waters of the flood. What does it mean for Ney? It means that he didn't get on until he felt the drop coming down. Well, what do you mean? So Rashi says he was a mamin, he ain't no mamin. Believe me, didn't believe. How's that possible? That means to say that certainly he believed. On an intellectual level, he had a level of conviction. And therefore he was saved, and therefore he built, he wouldn't have spent 120 years to build the ark. Yet there was, it wasn't a wholehearted belief. That means to say that he was not entirely convinced. It means to say that all of his emotions were not in line with his knowledge. There was something holding him back. That's mamin v'eino mamin. It was an incomplete conviction. That's a conviction. And I guess a lesser perspective, very hard perspective, I guess everybody partakes of that. That's, just, you know, there's a different level. And that's when a person, the weaker a person's conviction, the more apt he is to sin, to violate the laws of his heart, because there are parts of him that resist, there are parts of him that deny. He has elements of denial. So a person always has to work to strengthen that his conviction should be strong, should be firm, should be absolute, no doubt. Yisrael believed in God, but it wasn't what we would call emunah shlema. There was something lacking. That's what he said, I tell you that. There was something that was troubling him, and something was bothering him, and as a result of what he heard now, he underwent a complete transformation. Now, what was it that was bothering him, and what did he discover now, and what happened? To the beginning of the parasha here, what did he hear? It mentioned a lot of things, and Rashi mentioned a lot of things that he heard, different things. The man, you heard about Amalek, you heard about the air, the well, well, Rashi implied that there were different things there. But you got to stick to the plain meaning of the text. You can't veer away from the plain meaning of the text. He hosts the Hashem as he saw him in the time. That is the essential theme. Everything that he heard, but the most important thing was that God took him out of Egypt. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi, as Kolacherosa, Kolacherosa. Moshe told him everything. The Moshe was very careful on the way up from the sin. This meeting was very carefully arranged. Moshe had a purpose in mind. And when he told over the events to Yisroel, he knew Yisroel well. He had an objective in mind. Heis kolacherosa, Lahem, do you read us Haman? He told him about the man. He told him about Uzu Be'er, the water, that God provided water for them. Amalek, the war against Amalek. Tihoshi Hashem, Zu Gedol Al Kula. The Exodus, that was the most significant. That was greater than all of them. Later on, in Pasuk Chet is when they meet. This is just describing what you still heard. In Pasuk Chet, Vayisaper Moshe Lachos, Nal Ish Kol Yerasa, Hashem L'Paro. So Moshe told to his father-in-law everything that God had done to Paro and to Mitzrayim. The Rashi says, Vayisaper Moshe Lachos, Nal, he told over to his father-in-law, Limshokas Levo, to draw his heart, L'Karvo L'Torah, to bring him close to Torah. So Moshe told over, he was working on Yisrael. He was telling him the truth, but he planned it out very, very carefully to have the greatest emotional impact upon him. Now, so he told him about, what did he tell him? He told him about what God had done to Paro and to Egypt for the sake of the Jews. He told him about the travail in the wilderness by Atila Hashem, that God saved them. He told him everything. Now, what's the reaction of Yisrael? By Yichad Yisrael, Yisrael rejoiced all color over. He rejoiced for all the good that God had done, everything that he had done to Israel. I said, he see all the eyes of Israel. But the main cause of the rejoicing, take a look at Rashi again. Al Kol Tova, he rejoiced for all the good. Tova Haman, the good of Haman, the heir of Atova. The Al Kulan, but above everything else, I said, he see all the eyes of Israel. The thing that caused him the greatest rejoicing was the fact that he had saved the Jews from Mitzrayim. Ad achshav lo haya eved yochol levor from Mitzrayim. Up until this point, there was no slave who was able to run away from Egypt. Up until now, there was no slave who was able to escape from Mitzrayim, because the land was totally sealed off. And here, you had 600,000 people leaving. Now, let's take a look at his reaction. What does he speak about? What does he emphasize? Exactly. By Yom Yisro, by Baruch HaRashem, Asher Hitzolet from the Yad Mitzrayim. He praises God for what? He doesn't mention anything about the man, about the bear, but the whole emphasis of his blessing is, he saved you from Mitzrayim, Rashi says. Because he emphasized each particular. Miyad Mitzrayim Umar Kasha, a powerful nation. Umiyad Paro, Melech Kasha, a powerful king. Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim, under the enslavement of Mitzrayim. This is the thing that is, that made the greatest impact upon him. Right? So what do you have to assume was going on over here? What was going on? Yes?
Very good. You had the same mind. I think Roy presented it very well.
In other words, he was an individual. He was a free thinker. Because it says that the Rashi says, now you have the gods raised in all the other gods, but there are no other gods. So it teaches us that Yisrael had worshipped every... He said there wasn't one idolatrous system in the world, but he hadn't studied it and abandoned and rejected. You see that he was an honest, free thinker. In fact, I always used to say this answers the question. The question is, why these events were phenomenal? How come only one person came forth from the entire world and changed his philosophy of life? When God did these things, it was intended for the benefit of all of mankind. Now, why? Now they were in the triumph. They joined on because they were in the triumph. They saw the Jews were winning. I mean, from the rest of the world. Why weren't there... There must have been thinkers, people in the rest of the world. Yeah, why didn't people come forward to find out? Why? Well, because he was searching for the truth. That was his nature. He was searching for the truth. That's why he rejected every false system. He studied every system. Maybe they had something there. But since he was searching for the truth, when the evidence came along, it had an effect upon him. If a person is not searching for the truth, then there's no argument in the world that can have an effect upon him. That's a precondition. That's a precondition. Now, apparently, I would agree with what Lori said, that Moshe had educated him. Moshe helped him. And he found out, he knew about the whole situation about the Jews in Egypt, and I would say that that was something, it's a very powerful thing. It affects people in a powerful way. I mean, he was in a certain way, it was a very high level, but I would say that he was troubled by the question that troubles many people today about the justice of God. Yeah, that's the thing. And he had a concrete example before him in the situation of the Jews in the Messiah. How could this be? If God really, if there is a God and God governs the world and so on and so forth, then how could it be that God would allow such a blatant oppression to occur? This was troubling him. And when he found out about it, when he heard the news, you see, what did he hear? He heard about what caused him to come. What did he hear? He heard that God, he hosts the Hoshana, he saw him the triumph. What? He couldn't believe it. In other words, he, to a certain extent, and this troubles everybody, that's the whole question on people's mind. Is there really a God out there? Or no, it's just human form. And that's the whole idea of the war against Amalek. That people, when the Russia triumphs, it destroys people and people's emunah, that they believe that the only thing that counts is physical force. And if someone gets enough power, he controls the situation. Ah, so that means there's no God. If there's a God, then how could it be that these evil people are controlling the world? That's why the triumph of the Russia is a Chilul Hashem. And that's why the obligation to fight Amalek is really Kiddush Hashem. Because that shows that the wicked do not control the world. So when he heard that the Jews had got out of there, this had a tremendous impact upon him, and he had to come and find out. Yeah, Moshe Rabbeinu knew him. He knew Yisrael well. And when he sees, that's why he went out to meet him. And he told it over to him in a way that would have the greatest impact upon him. He told him all the particulars, all the details. See, but Davrach, that this was the hand of the Ashgacha. And we don't know why and when and how, but in the ultimate picture, God rules the world. And the righteous will triumph. And this is the, you see, that's why he was filled with joy. He was filled with joy for the sake of the Jews, because he was a righteous person, and he identified with the Jews that they were oppressed, because for him it was an injustice, and he just burst forth in praise of God. Now I believe in God completely. Now I'm a mommy. And tell me I believe in God. I did believe in God, but I had reservations. And I believe that that's why he's worth the Ola. See, the Karbon Ola is Kulo Hashem. It completely consumed on the altar, and man does not partake of it at all. What does it mean, man does not partake of it? Then he's what's wrong? It's the peace offering. The peace offering is part of it is for God, and then we can eat the rest. What's the idea of an Ola? when we have the Beit HaMikdash, you have to bring two tmidim, the regular, the carbon of every day, the one in the morning. We don't have the carbon after we've done shachar in the morning. That's because of the regular morning sacrifice, and the afternoon. That's the Dav Mincha. They were brought every day. What was the purpose of those two carbonos? They were for the tzibur, the congregation, the community, to atone. To atone for the sins that the Jewish people performed during the night, they would bring the carbon all in the morning. And to atone for the sins that the Jews performed during the day, they'd bring the one towards evening. Now, what kind of carbon was that? Ola. The Tamid Shel Kol Yom was a carbon Ola, which is completely consumed. So what did he represent? And they say that Yitzchak was an Ola Tamima. It's not a sin offering, but it serves as a machapet. It's not a sin offering. A sin offering is for a specific sin. For a specific sin. See, it means to say that now he changed the whole course of his life. There was two of them. He recognized he had not been living correctly. Even though he recognized God, but he didn't serve God totally, fully, with a complete heart. He couldn't, because he had doubt. And as long as a person has doubt, he can't be a complete Eved Hashem. So the first obligation for an individual who is seeking perfection is to remove the doubt from his heart. As long as a person says, yeah, look, a person has doubt, so he has that. Now, I'm not saying that he's not a believer. A person can be a believer. But if he wants to be perfected, then he has to remove the doubts, and he has to have total conviction, because as long as he has doubts, then his energy will not be going directly towards the service of God. Because he's not sure. And therefore he can justify it. When this emotion comes up, when that desire, he can justify it, because after all, he's not sure anyway. The Ola represented a new phase in his life. Now I'm Kulul Hashem. Kulul Hashem means, I believe it means like this. See, in the realm of ideology, in the realm of belief, Judaism does not tolerate any compromise. There's no compromise with the human element, with man's needs. In the realm of ethical perfection, like tshuva, the Rambam says, when a person does an avera, he has to tshuva. But tshuva is not just for a specific avera. Tshuva is also for your bad characteristics. Even if you didn't do a specific sin, the Rambam says a person is overly greedy. He has too much taiva. It means too much lust. So just this bad characteristic. He's too stingy. So he has to work on his emotions as well. Now the thing is like this though. There are certain sins where there's no, you have to do tshuva immediately. Right? In other words, a person, the Torah doesn't recognize that, well, I believe a little bit this year, and next year I'll believe a little bit more, you know, and or I'll keep one Shabbos every month this year and next month. In that area, it's absolute. In the realm of ideology, there's an absolute belief in that. You have to accept the yidgim l'ikarim, the essential, the fundamental principles. There's no room for human weakness over here. In the realm of perfection, the Torah doesn't expect that overnight you're going to be a... And you're working on your midos. A lush and highly very bad. I don't think the Torah expects that from one day to the next, the person is going to see. That's something that you got to work on yourself and perfect yourself and improve yourself. You see? There are seductions. Person has to perfect. There the Torah can understand that each person has his own needs, his own emotions, and there's a certain amount of tolerance. The machaper is, though, in terms of my ideology, in terms of my beliefs, I ascribe 100% to the use of the Torah. I may not be at this point perfected personally, but there's no doubt in my mind the Torah is good. Then that's why I think that the Olah is a machaper. Because as long as a person retains, he returns to the true system of ideas, so then he has an atonement. Because he'll work. He'll improve himself. But when a person gives up the true system of ideas, then he's in a very, very dangerous position. So Yisrael over here dedicated himself to a new way of life. It wasn't just that he heard and got excited and he prayed. It led to a personal change. Now I serve God with a full heart. Because now my emunah is complete. Because the obstacle to my emunah, this question that was troubling me, that how could God allow the Jews to suffer if there's justice? He was over. This was completely removed. You get it? This was not an emotional conversion. Where a person, if it was an emotional conversion, it wouldn't make sense. He wouldn't come to here. It didn't affect him. Nobody's excited about miracles that affect other people. I saw Hanukkah time. People are excited about a miracle if they can believe that God did something for them. And then it doesn't last too long. Right? Because it wears off. This was an intellectual process he was going through. He was in the process of study. As you said before, he was troubled by certain questions about God's justice. Now, the miraculous nature of the event convinced him that this was the hand of God. So it was an intellectual conversion. It wasn't the fact that he was excited. Yeah, 100%. He might not have. 100% he might not have. That's right. That's why no one said that he was on the highest level that you could possibly be on. He was on an extremely high level. No one's saying that. But that model, the Ashkenazi said he took advantage of the model. There were other people who had the same model to be around at that time. And to behold the same thing. Well, I didn't say he shouldn't change. Because first of all, I wouldn't say he said anything wrong. If a person, the Rambam says it's not the ultimate. If a person changes, he'll feel like, just, I don't know how many of you were adults during the time of the Nochemet Sheshesh Hayomim. Probably, this is probably for your time. I'm the only one. That doesn't strike me. The Persian Gulf crisis doesn't strike me. I disagree. I don't think there was anything of that could remotely compare to the miracle. Yeah, the story. Where the Jews go, If you remember the period beforehand, nobody at the time knew. As you see, most of you have been raised with the idea of this all-powerful Israel, that Israel could take on any combination. At that time, Israel was not regarded as being such a military power. And I remember the weeks leading up to it when Nasser was vowing to throw the Jews into the sea. This is right after the Holocaust, too. You're going back. This is a few years after the Holocaust. And nobody believed. I mean, Nasser had been armed to the teeth with Russian weapons. And the Sinai was filled up with 80,000 Russian troops and tanks and guns. And he had Syria on the other side and Jordan. They were surrounded on three sides. And they were prepared for a Holocaust. Nobody knew. Nobody had any idea. And it was about 3 weeks' time, Abba Eban was going around the world trying to drum up support. And Johnson, the United States, had a commitment from 1956. Israel had pulled out of the Sinai in exchange for commitment that the United States would come to their defense. And Abba Eban brought the papers with him to Lyndon Johnson, who was a friend of Israel. Lyndon Johnson was a friend of Israel. And he said he was embroiled in Vietnam. He couldn't do anything. And Israel stood alone. And then I remember waking up on a Monday morning. It's war. So for that day, everybody was in a state of tremendous suspense. Nobody knew what had happened. By evening, we found out there was a sneak attack. They knocked out all the air forces in a matter of an hour. And it was unbelievable. It was a knockout punch. And then at the end of the week, it was unbelievable. It was miracles. Everybody was using miracles. Miracles, miracles, miracles. And the Jews and all the schools were being filled up, raising money, and religious, non-religious reform. It was an unbelievable moment. All Jews were united. It was like people were going crazy. It was like a shiva thing. It produced what? No, it was a tremendous thing to God. I remember the emotion. You could not help but be affected by it. The Goyim. Gentiles were looking at you. If you walk down with the yarmulke, it's a different world. You weren't. Look, when I grew up, it was different than today. It's more acceptable. I mean, you could be a chassid. You know, people are accepting it because there's so many different ethnic groups. Nobody has to be ashamed to try and hide, whatever. If you just walk around wherever you are, people know the yarmulke, they know the beard. I mean, they know. And when I was young, it was different. It wasn't the same thing. I mean, in a certain place, you wouldn't wear a yarmulke, you wear a hat, cap. You know, you wouldn't. Today you go to Madison Square Garden, there's a bunch of kids with kippot and everything, you know. In my time, you'd wear a cap, a baseball cap, whatever. You didn't go around with the yarmulke. It wasn't that accepted. So, but then, the whole world was stunned. It was unbelievable. Now, how many of those conversions lasted? How many people were, on a permanent basis, became Dati, became from, changed their life because of that miracle? And there was no doubt in anybody's mind that this was a fantastic miracle. But you're right, that's your point, Laurie. That's your point. I don't know how many people. It produced profound effects in Israel and the government, and it led to the settlers, whatever. We're not going to go through all that right now. But I wonder how many people really changed their way of life in a permanent way and really became followers of Torah. I don't think so. And the truth of the matter is, that was offset in 1973 when the reverse, at least at the beginning, the setback and everything, goes the other way. You're right. That itself, strong emotional experiences like that, and whatever you want to say about the Persian Gulf, I don't believe that the Persian Gulf War made anybody from. There's not one person who ever came from. No. The point Laurie's making, that Yisrael was not affected by the emotion of the event, but rather it produced knowledge that he was searching for. He was a thinker. See? But of course you have to realize the emotion was trying to Moshe Klebo, that no matter how great a thinker he was, he had emotions too. But he used these emotions for the proper purpose, to increase the effect of the knowledge on his life. Okay. Now, when did this whole thing begin? Yisro was transformed, and after this point, Yisro converts, he becomes Jewish. According to Rashi, he became a Jew.
That's why
he said Yisro. Yeah. Where did this whole process begin? The process begins. See, the Torah doesn't give us too much information about the personal life of Moshe Rabbeinu. And especially, you know, things like who were his buddies, his friendship, things like that. But if you study the story very carefully, you'll see there was a friendship there. There was a very strong friendship between Yisrael and Moshe. It wasn't just Bosmo, they were a very great friend. Where did this friendship and relationship begin? It begins when the daughters came back. When the daughters came back and he asked his daughters, why did you come back so early? They said, an Ishmitri, an Egyptian, saved us from the shepherds, and also drew the water and watered the sheep. Now, I don't know if I pointed this out in this year before. But you see, when Moshe intervenes, he did two things. Like the girl who's driven off by the shepherds, Vayoka Moshe Vayoshion, Moshe arose and he saved them, Vayash Estonim, and he watered the sheep. Now, what's difficult about that? What doesn't make sense in what he did? Exactly. This question again doesn't bother people. What? He wasn't chivalrous and he wasn't a gentleman. Because the Torah doesn't believe in that. He was a tzaddik. And whatever he did because it made sense. Now, he acted according to chachma. He acted according to reason. Now, it made sense to save them. Because that was saving them from an injustice. They were being driven away. But once he had removed them from danger, so why did he have to go and war the sheep? That doesn't make sense. That's not his job, that's their job. Moshe was involved in an important area. He was studying Torah day and night. And besides that, everything has to be within limits. It doesn't make sense. You know, too much, too good is no good. You have an obligation. It would be the same thing, like a person is stranded on the road with flat tires. Nobody stops there, can't change the tire. So you're a righteous person, you pull over, you change the tire. Now, once you change the tire, they can drive. Now, do you have to go ahead and take him to a gas station and you get the thing fixed and run out of that and take him? His obligation was fulfilled when he sent them. Now, that was their job. They did this every day. Why did he have to waste time in that? And yet, you see, it's very significant. Again, no one ever is bothered by this question. It doesn't bother you. Now, why doesn't it bother you? Because it sounds good. So if it's pleased, what pleases you, opposed to emotion, he doesn't question. Well, they should have won in the first place. Where do you see that? No, but that's hard to say. Yeah, you're just positing that. Because he was interested in I gave it in Cologne, Columbia. So, some Jewish boys have a group there that I gave us here. So I gave them this point I mentioned. Like, why do you wear the sheep? So they all said, oh, gentlemen, this, that. And so, how do you explain the activities that Moshe, what is the totally real things about Moshe? And such a simplistic level. Oh, well, maybe he was interested in one of the daughters. That's why he did. That's not crazy. Well, that wouldn't be crazy because there's one problem with that. That wouldn't be crazy. Maybe he was attracted to one of the daughters and he did it because of that. But that wouldn't be crazy, but I know it's not the case. Because if that's the case, then why would he have let them go? Then he would have followed through. He would have made sure to go home with them or whatever, talk to them. I mean, if that was his motivation, he would have followed through. In reality, he left. And if it wasn't for Yisro's intervention and saying you had to bring him back, he would have been gone. So obviously he had no ulterior motive. The answer is that Moshe was involved in the performance of justice. Now, there are two consequences. There are two consequences of an injustice. What are the two consequences? One is the practical consequences. When somebody cheats you, when somebody treats you unjustly, so there's a practical loss, your money, whatever it is. You see that, your money, your labor, your time, whatever the case may be. That's the practical. But then there's another consequence of an injustice. When a person perpetrates an injustice against you, and this is far worse, there's a negation of your whole sense of worth as a human being. There's a negation of you as a person. They're saying you're nothing. And that leaves a scar on a person. I'll tell you, very often you'll find, you went to a store and it was supposed to be a sale or this, that, and you go home and you realize that they took advantage of you or they cheated you, right? The amount should be minuscule. It should be a couple of bucks. But it'll bother you very often. You'll write back and you'll demand justice and that. And you'll see that for the same amount of money, if you would have lost it somewhere, you're mindful. It's not that important. What bothers you? Like they made a fool out of you. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he practiced justice, he didn't just address himself to restoring the practical consequences, but he realized that the girls had been hurt psychologically as well, their whole sense of self-esteem. He wanted to do something personal for them, to give it back to them, to show them that they're very important people. He's doing a special favor just for them. That's justice on a totally different level. See, because justice gave them, that's not for them, but that could mean, it doesn't mean he cares about them, that could mean that he just doesn't in society, you can't tolerate injustice, that's not a personal thing. So when he went ahead and he rewarded the sheep for them, that was part of justice. Because this case demanded that he go further and restore their whole sense of importance as human beings. That's a different level. That the average person wouldn't do. Yes, so that's when the friendship began. When they came back, take a look at the puzzle. And everything will fit in. So they came back early and he said, what happened? He said, they said both things. An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. And also drew water for us and watered the sheep. So what did Yisro say? The owner opened the house, he said, "Hiyo, and where is he? Why did you leave this man? Call out to him and invite him for a meal." Now, of these, there were two reactions over there. Call him back and invite him to a meal. I understand. He saved you from a dangerous situation. Hakar Zatah. You all met. The first one is a criticism. Lamazah is asking us this. Didn't you notice something special about this person? That this person is different, that he's unique? How could you separate yourself? You should want to get close to a man like this. He's special, he's unique. You can learn something of a person like this. That's when the friendship began. Moshe took him in, not because he was looking for someone to marry his daughter off to. That wasn't the thing. Yisro took him in because he was a person who was interested in justice, who was searching for the truth, and he recognized that this was an individual kind of person, a unique kind of person, and that's the idea of the story. He began, Moshe at that point became his Rebbe, he became his teacher, and he forced him that he wouldn't abandon him. Whether it means literally or not, or not, it meant that Moshe recognized that since this person was struggling for the truth, he had an obligation to work with him, just like a Rebbe has an obligation to work with his home. And this began, that's what Rashi is alluding to. It's showing you the nature of the relationship. That he began to teach him ideas, because he recognized that he was an individual who had given up idolatry and searching for the truth. He became his teacher. And he forced him that he wouldn't leave him. Now later on, and he tells him about the situation of it. He tells him about where he came from. He told him about the Jews in the Mitzrayim. He told him everything. And as we see later on, he brought him up to a high level. When Moshe took his leave of Yisro, he had brought him to a high level. He was only missing, there was only one problem he was still grappling with. The problem of the Jews in the Mitzrayim. Now, when he goes back, now he has the command of God to go back. And He has to take his leave of Yisrael, because he can't just leave Yisrael. That question was, why doesn't he tell him the truth? Why doesn't he tell him why he's doing that? And why is he giving such a lame excuse? I'm going back to Egypt to see my brothers, see if they're still alive. Which is very, very lame. Now we can answer the question. Yeah? Words like this. You ever hear the Yiddish expression? How many, you know Yiddish? Yeah. You know, there's an old Yiddish expression which says, I live in Carmen Jorgen, and the man is stopped in Jorgen. Renee? You should know. Oh, okay, what's the problem? It means you're not allowed to tell a lie. It's a good point, by the way. It's a very good thing to try to write. No, but you don't have to tell the truth. See, a lot of times people hurt other people by telling them the truth. They get very, it's the truth, but you don't have to tell the truth. A lot of truth, you're not stuck. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to lie, but he didn't lie. Moshe didn't lie to him. Well, he said it's true. He's going down square. What do you mean? I'm going down to see the situation. I'm going to take a look and study the situation. Maybe I will be able, maybe I won't be able to interest. Let me see the situation. He had told him about his brothers. He had left them, what was doing. I'm interested now. I want to go back and see. Is this still alive? Whatever you want to say. Physically alive, spiritually alive. I want to check out the situation. That was true. What's that? Not about this. But the point of it is, he realized that Yisrael was caught up on this whole problem about the Jews and their needs. He wanted to use it. You see later on, when he tells him about the events, how he recounted it to him, he crafted the story. He told him the truth, but he told it in such a way to have the maximum impact upon his emotions. So this would effectuate a transformation. The most, you see, when that happens, the most effective thing is when he finds out for himself. Let him go with the suspense. I'm going down to Egypt. This means that he left Yisrael, and Yisrael was now wondering what's going to happen in Egypt. He was in a state of suspense. He had no idea. The situation was bleak. Then he followed. He kept track of what was going on. So that when, and all along, he couldn't believe. He couldn't believe that a nation like Egypt is the most powerful nation, most powerful thing. Is it possible for them to escape? He did it so that when the miracle actually did occur, it would have the maximum effect upon him. It was the most unbelievable thing, the surprise. But had he told him in advance that this is going to happen, and I'm going down, there's all plans, then it wouldn't have the same effect. Alright, you see? Once you know already, you see, like we in 67, we thought Israel was very weak, and that's around it. Now, let's say the commander, they told you about their contingency plans, about it, and in fact our weapons were superior, and in fact this, and we have a plan. If you're that's a big victory. In other words, you find a similar thing. It says by Yaakov, that Yaakov wanted to reveal the end. By a faith, right? PK's right? He wants to reveal the end about the Messiah. God didn't let him do it. God didn't let him do it. But God did not let him. That's the fact. The fact is that God did. It wouldn't be good for us. It wouldn't be good for us if we know the whole thing in advance. It wouldn't be good for us. It's better that we don't know. Certain things better that we don't know. The same thing over here. If he would have told him about the master plan, so then the whole thing would not have had the same effect upon him in the first place. But the event, there's a certain impact that the event has upon you, and precisely because you don't know, because all of your emotions, then he would have said, if that's the case, studying enslavement wasn't that bad in the first place. Really, it wasn't that terrible. I just didn't know. But you know what I'm saying? If he would have told him he's going down, we've got a plan, we're going to get out of there, so then already it starts to diminish the whole force of the enslavement. You see what he said? I say, he's left from Miyad Ephraim, Miyad Paro, Bitachas Yad Ephraim. In his mind, this was the mightiest force on earth, and it was impossible. There's no way, in the natural order of things, that anybody could get out of there. If they did, it's absolute proof of God. It would have been diminished if he was already, you have a way of getting them out of there, you know? So maybe it's not so terrible as Moshe. They're so confident that they can get out. Maybe I'm overestimating the extent of the enslavers. You see, to make a long story short, it's not going to have the same impact upon you. Once you know the ending in advance, it's not going to have the same impact upon you. The whole effect is a certain emotional effect that's very important over here. You see? And once you know the story, and once you know that he's going down there and this and that, but then when you know, well, maybe he had his emotion now, maybe it wasn't a big miracle. He had to be in a state. He has to be in a state where it, that's why Moshe played down the whole thing. He played it down. He made it seem like nothing. He didn't even give him a hint. He went down there letting Yisrael believe that this is an impossible situation. I'm just going to see if they're still alive. It'll be a miracle if they're still alive. That'll be a miracle. Let alone that I could do something. Maybe, who knows? I have an obligation to try. Now, they can still alive means to say in the sense whether they're still people, whether there's something there to say. Yeah, of course. But he played down the situation. He didn't want to build up any expectation. The more expectation you build up in a person's mind, the less the effect of the miracle. See? Yeah, so then it's not so big anymore. It's not going to be so big anymore. The more you build it up, the less the effect is going to be. Do you see that? Interesting that there was a tremendous bond between Moshe and Yisro over here. You see, when the reunion, in the reunion, Moshe goes out to meet him. He's like, Yishaku, he bowed down to him. That was respect because he was a farmer. But he's got close. And he kissed him. By Yavoa Ola, they got together in the tent. It was the renewal of a friendship which had begun with the time that Yisro first found out what Moshe had done for the daughters, and then he became his Rebbe, and he took you don't want to take little notes, but he obliged himself. He had an obligation to see this man through until he reached an Emunah Shleima, and he pleaded, then he was Magayer, and then he gave him advice as to how to set up the system, and Moshe pleaded with him not to leave, but then he left anyway, which is another story. That's a fascinating story. But that's why I believe that answered that question. That's why when he took leave and he went back to Mitzrayim, he didn't tell him the truth. Because he, for the sake of Yisrael, he realized that the events and the miracles which would unfold would have a tremendous impact upon Yisrael. And that he would only diminish the effect of these miracles if he were to tell him the plan in advance. Okay. It was not. He deliberately gave a very weak answer to keep it lame, to play down the whole thing. That was important. Not only did he not want to tell him that I have a whole plan to get him out of there, which would have diminished the whole impact, you see, but just the opposite. He wanted to play down the whole mission, not to give him any expectation whatsoever, so that he would be even more amazed. He wanted to play it down.